This is Radio Reorient, part of Network Reorient, the podcast arm of the Critical Muslim Studies Project. We aim to explore the post-Western and reconnect the Islamosphere. Welcome, listeners, old and new, to Season 10 of Network Reorient. We're now on our second episode of Season 10, and inshallah, full steam ahead with the rest of the season also. So, what's happened since I last spoke to you? I have to mention something because the irony is a bit too in your face, shall we say. We've obviously, for those following the news, we've heard of the bedbug outbreak in France, taking over their hotels, public transport, airports. There's already been one French TV personality who has blamed this on immigrants who do not have the same hygiene levels as those on French soil, quote unquote. But at the same time, the French authorities have advised people to cover themselves to fight this outbreak. And given the backdrop of the recent ban on abayas, the irony will not be lost on our listeners. Now, on to today's episode. In the realm of popular culture, representations of ancient Greeks and Romans abound in the West and Western adjacent societies. Classics, primarily focused on the study of Greeks and Romans, serve as Western history's foundational narrative. However, this narrative tends to create a timeline that excludes Muslim contributions and unintentionally supports the colonial racial agenda of the West. In this intriguing episode of Radio Reorient, Marcella Ward from the Open University and Abdul Karim Vakil from King's College London, hosted by Salman Said from the University of Leeds, engage in a discussion that explores the notable similarities and differences between two academic domains, critical ancient world studies and critical Muslim studies. Let's listen in.
This is Salman Sayed from Network Reorient. I write books and I produce this issue of Radio Reorient. I'm very delighted to have with me Abdul Karim Vakil from King's College London and Dr. Chela Ward from the Open University, who will be talking about ancient world, critical ancient world studies and critical Muslim studies. Abdul Karim.
Chela, one of the things that is interesting about your project is that you introduced the notion of critical ancient world studies. And a way of positioning it is by talking about a move away from classics as a discipline. Could you start us off in that way, to position critical world studies, ancient world studies, in relation to classics?
Yeah, absolutely. So classics, I mean, itself is a kind of difficult term. I think people often, when they think of the term classics, they think of things that are just really old. But classics as a discipline refers in theory to the study of the ancient world. But in fact, it's increasingly understood by me and by many other classicists as a discipline that grew up alongside colonialism as a way of making the case for Eurocentrism and for the importance of the so-called West in the world. So critical ancient world studies is a project that is about taking aim at that coloniality of the discipline, and kind of rewriting some of the core assumptions that helped classics and classical studies to be so useful to the colonial project.
So there are at least three things that you've already mentioned there. One is the way that it institutionally sits within a particular division of knowledge and of disciplines. Second, the way that it relates both temporally and worldly to the enterprise of colonialism and presumably also state building. And third, the way that as a discipline, let's call it that for the moment, it was also a pathway of social ascension for particular elites. And all of that is inscribed into, in turn, a particular reading of Europe and the West in relation to what you call broadly the ancient. So, how do you unravel those different dimensions within a project such as Critical Ancient World Studies?
Well, within the Critical Ancient World Studies project, we essentially, I mean, I should say that, you know, this is a project that I co-run with a colleague, Madhurima Chandran, who works at Exeter University. And we also, I mean, we sort of talk about ourselves as co-runners of the project, but really it's a collective. It's a kind of global collective made up of scholars, many of whom at the time when we started were themselves early career scholars, precarious scholars. Some of us have become less precarious in the time that we've been running the project. Some have become more precarious as the neoliberal university has pushed them sort of further to the edges of academia. So it came from a position of a problem with classics as a discipline that was both, on the one hand, political, and was a sort of experience of the discipline that didn't sit well with many of the people who were involved in it. So people come, I guess I'm saying all of that to explain to you that people come to the project from a huge variety of different angles. I have my own very specific take on it, which is particularly in its interaction with critical Muslim studies, so I guess we'll get to that later. But people have come to it through, for instance, Afrocentrism, through intersectional feminisms, through working class activisms too. So there are lots of kind of different ways to decenter the classical. And when we got together to try and think about what would differentiate critical ancient world studies from classical studies, or in other words, what that term critical would mean, because this is increasingly a term that is getting prefixed to lots of different academic disciplines, and I have a slight worry that there's a sort of hollowing out of that term, a little bit like what we saw happening with the term decolonial. So we wanted to sort of make sure that as a collective we were agreed on certain critical steps. And those critical steps, if we have time, I can run through them quickly. Mm-hmm.
That would be useful. You don't have to do it quickly.
Okay. So those critical steps were essentially four. So firstly, it was, and probably most importantly, and probably the thing that unites the collective most strongly is the critique of Eurocentrism. And so it's about trying to speak against the idea that the West is a transhistorical universal, or that the West is a thing that really exists. So it's about trying to speak against that. And that's, of course, the idea of the West is, of course, something that the notion of the classical has lent huge support to. It has acted as the West's kind of triumphalizing foundation myth, in a sense, in a way that, you know, is completely false and dishonest, but has nonetheless marked the history of the world. So that was the first critical step away from classics, was to critique Eurocentrism. And in doing so, to reject the universal, or to stop the universal from functioning as a synonym for the Western. That was the first step. Secondly, it was about the rejection of a relationship between classics and cultural value. So this notion that classics is about things that are universally, in a sense, valued. It was about rejecting that assumption. And with that, also rejecting this notion of cultural capital, rejecting the idea that the classics were a sort of elite thing to know about and they belong to a certain category of people. Thirdly, it was about a denial of positivism. It was about not trying to establish approaches to history that claimed to be transparent, or claimed to be views from nowhere, is often the phrase that gets used of that kind of transparency. But that transparency was, in our view, a false transparency. And it was established by certain perspectives, often sort of, you know, white, male, middle-class perspectives, masquerading as if they were neutral. And that's something lots of academic disciplines struggle with. That's not just a classics problem, but it's put under a microscope in classics by the fact that, historically speaking, knowledge about the ancient world has been restricted to certain groups of people, and it's still the case that for some people it's much harder to gain that knowledge than others. So that was the third thing, was to re-embody, in a sense, what it means to know about the ancient world, by which I mean to acknowledge diverse perspectives on the ancient world and to get rid of the idea that it's possible to know the ancient world objectively or transparently in any way. And then the fourth one was one that we struggled for a little while to give voice to. We talked a lot about decolonizing the gaze of and at antiquity, by which we meant this sort of imagine two-way street between the, you know, Eurocentric colonial imaginary of the world and the ancient world, or Greece and Rome, which is what makes up most of the colonial imaginary of the ancient world. So it's this kind of retrospective mirror, in a sense, that colonialism could look back in and could see this kind of glorified, entirely mythical prehistory for Western supremacy. And we wanted to acknowledge that as a colonial trope. And so we talked about decolonizing this gaze of and at antiquity. But what we wanted to do in doing that, we were sort of cautious about that word decolonial. And what we didn't want was for critical ancient world studies to become simply the application of decolonial theory, because that's something that increasingly disciplines are very able to do. They're able to say, I'm taking this concept from Mignolo and I'm going to stick it onto my field of study, and I'll do my field of study almost exactly as I was doing it before, except I'll do it in Boaventura de Sousa Santos's terms, or I'll do it in Walter Mignolo's terms, or I'll do it in even Francois Verger's terms, or whoever I consider to be a, you know, a decolonial thinker. So we, rather than do that, so rather than just have decolonial theory sort of applied to the classical without shifting its epistemological structures, what we meant by commitment to decolonizing the gaze of an antiquity was really thinking about structures of knowledge, was really thinking about the way that, and I'm going to use the word epistemology to mean structures of knowledge, even though it's a little bit jargon-tastic, but we wanted to think about the way that, that classics as a discipline has been relatively epistemicidal insofar as it has stopped lots and lots of different epistemologies from engaging with the ancient world in order to kind of impose certain ways of thinking about the ancient world and certain structures for thinking about the ancient world. We can maybe come onto some of those structures in a moment, but those were the four moves.
So in your own work, you make particular connections with the question of critical Muslim studies and a relationship to Orientalism that we'll come to, and which I'm sure someone will have a lot to say. But just before we get into that, just in terms of setting the project at the start, mm-hmm. just two quick questions. One is, so it shares quite a lot of traits with broader processes of challenging the kind of institutional curricula, who was teaching at universities, within a broader front of decolonization worldwide, but then also of the transformation of universities in the West, on the one hand. But on the other, there is the fact that where those are more commonly spoken about, in departments of literature, in cultural studies, in history, in the humanities, which were particularly significant in the period of the 60s onwards, which is precisely where that where those transformations were impacting. These were disciplines with a renewed cachet in the 60s, whereas classics was being marginalized as something that only elite schools would teach. Mm-hmm. So to what extent does that matter or not matter to whether the project you are describing is a come lately, or how it relates to these processes that have already been undertaken?
I think it is hugely indebted to those processes. And the reason I say that is partly because I think that it's a mistake for anybody who wants to do any kind of work about decolonizing to think that they're the first to do that kind of work. I think that's just an enormous kind of hubristic error to make. And I think you know, critical ancient world studies was to sort of list its debts. Maybe we shouldn't talk in terms of debt, but if it was to sort of list its influences, I think it should first and foremost be thinking about classics departments in the global south, where especially African classics departments, where there has for a long time been a discussion about what it means to teach classics in Africa, because the conversation about the inadequacy of the methodological tools of classics to deal with a global ancient world, or with an ancient world that might carry within it some kind of decolonizing potential, that has often been articulated around Africa. And very, very famously, it was articulated around Martin Bernard's Black Athena book. But what is, and we in the introduction to the Critical Ancient World Studies volume, which should be out by the end of this year, Mather and I set up that volume, or those volumes, Black Athena by Martin Bernal, we set that up as a missed opportunity for classics, as a moment where classics could have taken the opportunity to really reckon with some of the exclusions and some of the biases and some of the epistemological just inadequacies of the discipline.
For some of those less familiar, can you situate it in time?
I can, yeah. So it's 1980s. It's 1980s, and it comes out as a series of volumes. And Martin Bernal was not himself a classicist. He's a sinologist. And that caused, the fact of him not being a classicist caused classics to really not take these books particularly seriously, because essentially the argument of the book was that the ancient Greeks in particular ought to recognize their intellectual debt to ancient Africa more than they do. And it spawned a whole series of responses, very negative, hostile responses, among them a book called Not Out of Africa. So that, I think that the title of that book gives you a sense of why classicists were angry about Black Athena, and gives you a sense of kind of the strength of the reaction against it. And a lot of the reaction against Black Athena was framed around the notion of historical inaccuracy. It's framed around sort of small things that Martin Bernal had done because he was not himself a specialist. But what happened was that in classics, until very recently, those errors became the focus of the discussion rather than the broader philosophical provocation that he was making, which was essentially that the methodologies of classical studies were inadequate for, he didn't say a decolonizing study of the ancient world, but they were inadequate to do any kind of more critical thinking around even just interconnected philosophies between ancient Greece and ancient Africa. So it's absolutely not the case that we're the first to have this conversation. For me, it's even more important that we have it, though, on the basis of the fact that we were invited to have it many times before, and the discipline simply refused, and in the case of Martin Bernal's book, refused really quite violently. But there are a number of other disciplinary moments that I could point to, you know, one of which would be the advent of classical reception studies, which seemed like, for a moment, it might cause classics to radically change its methodology. And in a sense, it did, but not in the kind of critical sense that critical ancient world studies is trying to push. So there are a number of opportunities in which classics could have had this reckoning, and it didn't just not have the reckoning, it refused to have the reckoning. And perhaps when the book comes out, it'll refuse again. I don't know. I hope that won't be the case.
So much of what you've described in relation to the response to Black Athena would be familiar to those who know the response to Orientalism.
Exactly.
Salman? Just want to add to that. I mean, again, to pick up the thing on Orientalism, one of the main problems that confronted the reception of Orientalism was precisely that the specialists, especially in the study of the Orient of the Middle East, so-called, picked on these minor details. And in fact, if you look at their entire counter response to the book, it's often about, well, he got this detail wrong, got that detail wrong, rather than meeting the argument. And somehow the argument is supposed to be invalidated by these empirical details. And part of that, of course, is that what both Middle Eastern studies or Islamic studies share with classical studies is a deep-seated empiricism born out of their kind of positivist responses. So I think there is certainly an overlap there. I just wanted to go back because you talked about many of the epistemologies that were closed by a particular imposition of the classical epistemology. It might be good for our listeners if you could name one or two examples of that in relation to what epistemologies have been closed by this configuration of classical studies.
So I think perhaps the most straightforward way to answer that question is to think about what most people think they know about the ancient world, or what most people are empowered to imagine when they think of the ancient world. And most people, if you say to them the ancient world, they have an image that is, you know, an image of marble pillars and its statues and its togas, and maybe it's a Roman centurion, or, you know, maybe it's somebody in this, a woman in the streets of Pompeii selling food or something. It's a very restrictive image of the ancient world. And we see that in all sorts of branches of study. We see it in the study of ancient sexualities, for instance, where we get this retrospective mapping of modern sexualities, post-colonial sexualities, onto the ancient world in a way that's hugely restrictive for our understanding of how ancient people engaged with each other. So I think when we think about the places that we don't know in the ancient world, when we think about the languages that either took a very long time to transliterate or have simply never been transliterated, there's a huge amount of unknowns, and there's a huge amount of things that sit outside of what we think of as ancient. And where you hit on some kind of really interesting questions is when you try to think about communities around the world that have really ancient claims, or still today have ancient claims to places. I'm thinking of, indigenous communities, for example. And we don't really have a framework for thinking through that kind of ancientness in the same way as we think about ancient Greekness, even though, you know, most classicists, if they're being honest, would say that they know exactly how ancient Greekness is used as a faux claim to a kind of indigenous European figure, right? So there's all these things that aren't known. And in that unknowing is a kind of weaponizing of, you know, this image of Greekness. And where that image of Greekness actually comes from, you know, if you're to ask the question, did ancient Greece really look that way? To which, of course, the answer is no. The big sort of populist way that argument has been made recently is about the painting of statues, that we know that statues were actually very colourful, but we've imagined them to be white marble. But where that comes from is North America's claim to its own power and its own establishment. If you look at those kind of huge institutional buildings, founding father buildings in North America, what you see is Greek pillars. You see the same thing at the British Museum. You see that huge colonnade of Greek pillars. And what that is about on the part of the British Museum is about staking a claim of ownership to the things that the British Museum has stolen from all around the world. And it's a Greek claim to ownership. It's a claim to primacy. So I guess the way that we see the loss of those epistemologies is all of the communities around the world today who are disempowered from claiming their own primacy.
Okay. Well, I mean, that just leads on to another question, really, which I thought was worth thinking about, because in a lot of these, let's say, decolonizing disciplines, one of the response to charges of essentialism, Eurocentricism, is a kind of a almost weak sense of pluralization. And, of course, you can talk about global ancient world studies, where you say, well, okay, we know that in the past it was focused on the Mediterranean, but we can now bring more and more into the ambit. Now, what I understand from the Critical Ancient World Studies project, that's not what it is. Maybe you could talk a little bit about what's the inadequacy of that kind of global expansion. And also, in relation to the indigeneity, I guess the question would be, how do different framings of time and temporality fit into the schema of an ancient world? What is the ancient world?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So I'm going to answer that question, if you don't mind, by taking a couple of steps back from it, first of all, and saying what my own commitment is to the Critical Ancient World Studies project. And that's because everyone, as I began by saying to you, Abdul Karim, everyone within the collective has their own sort of specific reason for being there. And my reason for being there is that I see a specific problem. There are many, many problems, but I see a specific problem with the way that classical studies has naturalized a kind of world narrative into being. And that's the exclusion of the Muslim from that world narrative. So just to say quickly what I mean by that, when we set up the timeline of the world according to classicism, we end up kind of saying, well, you know, the ancient world, maybe it begins in the 8th century BC with Homer. Let's just take that as an arbitrary starting point. Everyone knows there was something before then, but if you're an undergraduate and you're studying classics, maybe that's where you start. And then it ends, you know, maybe with the fall of Rome. Let's just say that. So
which Rome?
Well, I could go on about that question for a long time, but you end up with a kind of normative timeline where if I want to explain to somebody what I do as somebody who researches and teaches classical studies, I have to do that by means of time. I have to say I study the ancient world. And then the question that obviously follows is, when is that ancient world? Where is it and when is it? But when is the most important question, because it's identified by its ancientness, right? I've not yet said anything about where. I've not said Greece. I've not said Africa. I've not said any of those places. We have to define ancient. And that timeline of the ancient world is almost every classicist, I think, would acknowledge almost impossible to define. No one can tell you when it starts. No one can tell you when it finishes. But there's one thing, there's one trope that is repeated constantly when we talk about the end of the ancient world, and that's that the ancient world ends categorically before the coming of Islam, or in some framings is ended by the coming of Islam. That's, I think, what Edward Said reproached in Edward Gibbon's reading of The Fall of Rome, was that he said, I think, it's not a direct quote, but he said something like that the fall of Rome, that Rome finds its fall in the rise of Islam. So what that does, and it's not always positioned quite so obviously antagonistically as Rome versus Islam. That's a particular way of framing it. But it is still today almost always the case that Islam comes after the end of the classical. And we see that even in global volumes. There's a very recent volume, I think it was 2022, that came out with Routledge, that's called, the title is something like A Global History of the Ancient World. And then the subtitle is Asia, Europe and Africa Before Islam. And that's 2022, that book. So this is not something from the prehistory of classics when we were all white male Victorians. This is something that's very much still living. And what that does is that creates a problem, because it means that the Muslim ends up having to function both as something that brings about the end of this falsely glorified ancient Europe. So there's a kind of intrinsic antagonism that's set up there. But also the Muslim then has to be something that is categorically different, or what the philosopher Catherine McKittrick would call a fictive difference, right? There has to be a fictive difference engineered, by which I mean we have to kind of force the Muslim to feel completely different to the ancient Greek or the classical in order to get the classical to function as the pre-European and the Muslim to function as the kind of end of that classical. So this creates, I think, a hugely sort of Islamophobic world picture, where you end up, and it's not that dissimilar to other kinds of Islamophobic world framings, like the opposition between the West and the rest, for instance. It's not too different from that, but it is specifically Islam that ends up causing a problem for the classical, or ends up ending the classical. So for that reason, I guess the book that I've just referred to, the book that carries the subtitle Asia, Europe and Africa Before Islam, in a sense answers your question, because it is absolutely possible, unfortunately, to expand the gaze of the classical to encompass the entire world without that gaze becoming any less colonial or any less problematic, right? And that is something, I mean, there is this movement in classics that's referred to as global classics, which is about, and it's essentially seems to me to be driven by a sort of EDI, a sort of equality, diversity, inclusion agenda, where what we want to do is we want to take the frameworks of the classical and we want to put everybody into those frameworks, force everyone to fit into those frameworks. And for all the reasons that underline the failure of that sort of neoliberal approach to inclusion everywhere else in the world, I mean, this is a very common institutional or critique of institutional EDI programs, is that they essentially sort of eradicate difference and they force everyone to fit into these same categories in a way that's, you know, not at all fair to large numbers of people. In that same way, I think Global Classics as a project runs the risk of trying to use the methodologies of classical studies all around the world, where, I mean, A, they're just not going to work, and B, if they did, what we would be seeing, because the methodologies of classical studies are trained on the colonial imaginary of ancient Greece and ancient Rome, all we would be doing is looking in the rearview mirror of colonialism at these other places. We'd be sort of angling that mirror slightly differently. And it would produce, you know, I fear, the same outcome, or even a much worse outcome. So it wasn't enough for critical ancient world studies to say, we want the field of our investigation to be global. Most of us think that the field of our investigation should be global, but that alone will not solve the problem of the coloniality of classical studies.
Let me play Iblisa's advocate for a moment here and ask you what you just said. Someone, you know, in your field says, okay, I agree with that, I'm happy to go with this. But then what is the terminus point of the ancient itself? That can be for pragmatic reasons. At some point, undergraduates need to finish their degrees, and what do they need to cover? But I suppose a more deeper epistemological point is that if you remove the idea of Islam, and you can see that there's a way that you've described it in much of the older epistemology, that it really is the alien full stop to these kind of developments. But even in a more recent book, like, for example, Fowden's book from, talks about Islam achieving a world state, which neither the Romans or the Persians are able to do so, because, you know, particular kind of configuration, all of that, which would suggest a less hostile full stop, in a way. So the issue would be then, what when do we stop saying something is ancient, if we ever do? And if that is the case, what are the characteristics or the family resemblance that allows us to say, well, this is no longer the purview of something who someone who would be studying the ancient, however you determine it?
Well, at the risk of sounding like Bruno Latour's "We Have Never Been Modern," I'm not that sure we've ever been ancient either, or that we've ever been not ancient. I'm deliberately not using the word modern as the opposite of the word ancient, because that sets us up in the same timeline. So in a sense, you've asked two questions there. One is, theoretically speaking, when is the end of the ancient world? The second is, pedagogically speaking, when is the end of the ancient world? Which is a different question, and I think, you know, all of us would acknowledge that pedagogy sometimes requires different things of us than theorizing requires, or decolonial theorizing in particular. But I think that what would connect those two questions for me is that I think we ought to be more honest with students than we're being. Because I think at the moment, we are presenting students with a particular kind of curriculum in many institutions, not all, but in many a 19th century classics curriculum, which is still teaching kind of major canonical authors and is still thinking that certain things are non-negotiables. For instance, you know, look at the huge arguments that found their way into various newspapers when Oxford University decided to reduce by 2 books the amount of Homer that undergraduates were required to read in Greek, and that was sort of all over the papers for a few weeks. So there's huge attachment to precisely the conservatism of this curriculum, not just within universities, and in fact, probably not for the largest part in universities, actually. I think a lot of attachment to that curriculum is coming from outside of universities. That's a different question that maybe we can come on to. But I think what it speaks to is the fact that because access to the ancient world is so restricted outside of undergraduate curricula, there is a huge importance on what we teach undergraduates, not least because so many of those undergraduates who've studied classics, because of the elitism of the subject and its feeder schools, so many of the people who study classics will go on to run various countries around the world, will go on to be, you know, prime minister, unfortunately. So there's a huge responsibility around those who teach this subject at an undergraduate level. And I'm not convinced that in all places we're really living up to that responsibility at the moment. And to bring this back to your question about when does the ancient world end, I think we've got to stop so simplistically presenting the ancient world as sort of finite in that way to students. I think that we've got to get them to think much more critically around what they're being taught. And I think part of the way that we do that is by, in a sense, letting them in on the secret of the discipline, which is that classics has always functioned, the way I describe it, as like a kind of European futurism, by which I mean it's a way of organizing the world such that European supremacy is kind of the only telos, the only endpoint that was possible for world history. But of course, we all know that wasn't the case, right? But it naturalizes that world narrative. And the question is, what do we do about that? And what do we do pedagogically about that? Insofar as we do still need to be able to teach these things, and that we don't have total control over how people understand the ancient world either. So students come in often wanting to learn about Homer, wanting to learn about Aristotle, thinking that they are going to find that all Greeks are massively misogynistic because that's what the world has told them. Thinking that, you know, all Romans are white, for instance, is another very common thing that's completely untrue, but people often think it. So, I mean, I think one of the ways we do that is be really honest with students and say, this thing that you're going to study is a colonial discipline, and that's why it looks the way that it looks. But we're going to enable you to study that in such a way that you're going to be able to look back through all of those layers of coloniality and unpick them. So rather than teach you, rather than pretend to transparently teach you about the ancient world, we're going to teach you not just how to decolonize the ancient world, but we're going to teach you how and why the ancient world constructed the colonial world narrative in which we still live. And I think that that would have the effect of making the subject way more interesting. First of all, I think that'd be fascinating. I think it would attract a much more diverse group of students to study it, because that total lack of particularly racial and ethnic diversity is another massive problem for the discipline. And I think that it would be a more honest way of framing the curriculum without getting into the sorts of problems that world literature has to get into, where it's suddenly you can teach everything and then how do you decide what to teach? And of course, what you do is you fall back on your own assumptions about what's important. And those assumptions, of course, end up being, you know, just as Eurocentric and just as colonial as the original assumptions that were structuring the field. So I think it's about being honest with students. I think we have the ability to transform this into a really serious tool for decolonial thought, but we have to let students be at one remove from the discipline and understand it to be a discursive construction of coloniality. We have to empower students to do that.
I think one of the things that strikes me, being in a department of modern languages, of history, of cultures, and of comparative literature, is precisely how both the pedagogical as well as the theoretical questions are questions that we each grapple with in our own departments. Mm-hmm. And part of the issue is that we need to talk more mm-hmm. to each other so that we're not constantly reinventing wheels. But on the other hand, that part of it is having a reckoning with your own discipline mm-hmm. and knowing the history of your own discipline and the institutional history of your own discipline. And I think that one of the things that perhaps may or may not differentiate classics, and I'd like to hear you say more about this, is the fact that collections of antiquities, the relationship between classics and museums, is tied to two processes. One is the way in which decolonizations of so much of the colonial world then led to the formation of nationalist governments that in turn had to assert their own national histories in dialogue with, paradoxically, reappropriating particular narratives, which were Western narratives of where they came from. But secondly, state ownership of so much of these collections, and therefore questions of access, questions of who gets to tell the story, and particularly who gets to tell the story, you know, officially for museums that control those narratives. So is that specific to classics? Is it just differentially particular rather than unique? And the second thing, or perhaps I can do that one differently, is that, as you've said, it is a discipline that, relatively speaking, is impacts a very small segment within the educational structures, as well as numerically, although disproportionately so because of who they are and what elites they become. But classics as such, and the question of the ancient, is so much more important at the level of, I wouldn't say perhaps popular culture, but certainly of common culture. And there, one of the things that we did want you to speak a little bit about, because I think it does speak to hegemonies, is the question of how to impact a much broader audience, which is children, mm-hmm. which you have written yeah. about. So perhaps you could say something about those two.
Yeah, I have a lot to say about children in the ancient world. Let me sort of preface it by saying, though, that I now work in a department. So I work now for the Open University. So I now work in a department where it is no longer true that there is an elitism around who can study classics. I mean, that's not to say there aren't any access problems in the Open University, because of course there are, like any institution. But I now work in a department that has, you know, more than 1,000 undergraduate students who come from all walks of life, from all over the country. It's and who many of them have, you know, no history at all of any kind of engagement with classics, classical languages, or anything like that. So it's very different to where I worked previously. I was in Oxford for more than a decade prior to that. So I know kind of the most elitist way of gaining access to the discipline, and also what is perhaps one of the least, at least within higher education as a structure. So do I think that that problem is specific to classics? No. I do think that classics has a particular kind of relationship with museum collecting that is sort of in a way at the heart of some of the defences of the discipline, or some of the refusals to change the discipline. I think that it would be wonderful to see more colleagues advocate openly for the restitution of artifacts to the places they were stolen from. I think that would be wonderful. I think part of the reason that we don't see that is because you know, many universities have teaching collections, for instance, or they rely on a collection of a museum for their teaching. So there's this kind of interdependence in a way that is in a sense a dependence on the colonial project, right? Because it's a dependence on colonial collecting. There's this kind of dependence on those mechanisms without which many classics curricula would be much poorer. And I think that's the sort of fact of the discipline that when we talk about the Parthenon marbles going back, which I'll say on record, I 100% think they should do immediately and should have done many years ago. When we talk about, or you know, any other artifact that doesn't get as much coverage as the Parthenon marbles, equally should go back to where it was taken from. But when we talk about that, I think we also need to be honest about the impacts of that for the discipline. For me, I think that's a huge opportunity. I think that we ought to be thinking speculatively. We ought to be imagining what it would be like not to have ownership as our kind of core reason for studying things. I think there are many, many more equitable ways to relate to collections or to relate to artifacts that maybe aren't even in European or Western collections. I think there are many other ways of relating to those objects phenomenologically or emotionally, or I think if we didn't own them, we'd have to find other ways of relating to them. And that for me is really exciting because I don't think the ownership should be the way that we define our enthusiasm for things. But yeah, coming back to your question about children, I write for children. I have done for a number of years now, mostly children's nonfiction. I've just written a book that's called Gods of the Ancient World for Dawning Kindersley. That came out in September. Its sequel, Legendary Beasts of the Ancient World, will come out in September of this year. And those books, both of them, are about trying to get children, young children, children you know around the age of 7 to 9, trying to get them to think much more critically about the ancient world. And I do that, I mean, basically just because I have huge optimism for the role that children and young people play in the world. I think that they are chronically and criminally underestimated. I think that children are capable of so much more than we expect of them. With the world's attitude to children is often so patronizing. We think that everything has to be simplified, that they can't deal with moral questions, that they can't deal with kind of big epistemological questions, ethical questions. Children are fantastic at all of those things. I mean, of course they can deal with that kind of thing. So is it helpful for me to say a little bit about how I do that in the books, or do you want me to say more about the books?
You can say that. Or not.
Yeah, okay. So, I mean, basically, the way that comes through in the books, it varies a little bit. The way you write about gods is different to the way you write about monsters, but the way that comes through is, first of all, by taking the site of investigation of those books as deliberately very, very global, which, although I said for the Critical Ancient World Studies project that was not enough, it's of course not enough, but it is an important starting point for children because the ancient world that children are exposed to within their curriculum and within the sorts of books that are available to them, it's changing slightly now, but it's taken a very long time. Their diet of ancient things has basically been Greeks and Romans, Vikings, and occasionally Egyptians. That's really it. And that does a huge disservice to children who...
And Sumerians.
Well, occasionally Sumerians, but not that often.
No, but it does a disservice to Sumerians because you have Egyptian mythology, but you don't...
Oh, absolutely. Yeah, yeah. I mean, it does a disservice to Sumerians. It does a disservice to, you know, all of ancient Africa, all of ancient Asia. I mean, it's enormously restrictive and unfair to many, many children who simply do not see themselves or their families reflected in the pictures of ancient Greece and Rome that have been sat in front of them for years and years. Part of the point was to, in small ways, get children to see that the way that the world is now, especially that kind of world of museum collecting, is not how it necessarily needs to be. And to get them to even just start asking the question of, you know, why these artifacts from ancient China are sitting in the British Museum, for instance. And there are a number of... So there's partly that kind of material history that, you know, children are going to be the generation that send artifacts back to where they came from, I think, I hope. So it's partly about giving them the tools to be able to start thinking about that. But when we started looking at those artifacts, we unearthed a number of really, really interesting questions because artifacts don't tell always the neat stories that colonial museums would like them to tell. And one of the artifacts that is actually in the God's book is it's a tile. It's a kind of Silk Road artifact. I guess that's how the museum would label it. And it's a tile that very clearly it has a phoenix on the tile. And then it has lots of kind of vegetal patterns around the tile. Very, very clearly, anyone who's, you know, been to Iran or has seen that kind of Islamic imagery, it's very, very clearly a sort of Islamic art image. But it was found somewhere in northern China.
So, I mean, this is quite interesting, and I want to talk about this, because one of the things is that by finding a artifact of the Islamic Age, which is before the timeline of the officially sanctioned timeline, actually goes back to the point you started off with, mm-hmm. talking about that relationship between Muslimness and the critical ancient world. Because one of the ways you can talk about Muslimness is how it kind of interrupts, not willfully, mm-hmm. but just seems to interrupt many of the contemporary formations which talk about their own kind of beginnings mm-hmm. as either post-Islamic in a sense, or pre-Islamic. And, you know, you can see the similar kind of thing working in India, where you have attempts to go before and try and find a pristine Hinduness already preserved, which has been shorn of any kind of interaction or traces. Mm-hmm. And you can see the similar kind of things in other parts, in Spain and Europe, etc. So what I think it does is perhaps put the question around the ancient world as a legitimator of, or the notion of the ancient world as a legitimator of contemporary formations, mm-hmm. and the construction of Muslimness as the potentially disrupting mm-hmm. that narrative. And perhaps that might be a good way for us to sort of reflect and conclude with a reflection really on that relationship that you think you saw around critical Muslim studies and ancient world studies, and critical ancient world studies.
Yeah. So, I mean, you're absolutely right that the issue with the artifact was that it spoke against this kind of dominant narrative that Muslims came late to the history of China. Of course, what this very old artifact shows is that Muslims came very, very early to the history of China. So it speaks against that kind of state narrative that is in particular so violent to the Uyghur people. But there are a number, that's just one kind of small example of the ways in which the timeline, you know, is neither a particularly true nor a particularly useful way of thinking about the interaction or the way that world history ought to be organized. And I think one of the things that I find myself saying very often about the project of critical ancient world studies, which I think is similar to some of the things that I've heard you saying about the project of critical Muslim studies, is that I really want a new history of the world. And I want a new ancient history of the world that's going to set up, that's not going to toe the line and set up the colonial world system in which we live, but is going to allow us to imagine a much more equal world, a decolonized world, one that isn't constrained by those categories and those systems of coloniality.
Jella, thank you so much for your time and for those critical connections between, or the criticalities of critical Muslim studies and the criticalities of critical ancient world studies. Merely the beginning of a dialogue, which I trust will be very productive.
And thank you ever so much for having me. Critical Muslim Studies was hugely, hugely influential on the beginnings of the project of critical ancient world studies. So it's a huge joy to be in conversation.
I mean, the only thing I would like to add is I think this, when you finished on the Yaja project, we have two projects of trying to rewrite, reorient a history of the world. And I think it's a dialogue between critical Muslim studies and critical ancient world studies becomes, I was going to say critical, for the project of rewriting a history of the world, for all the reasons we've already said. So I hope this will be the beginning of a fruitful dialogue going forward.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
This has been an episode of Radio Reorient, brought to you by Network Reorient, part of the Critical Muslim Studies Project. Your host has been Hiza Mir, and the episode has been sound engineered by Zubair Vakil. Thank you for tuning in. Have a listen to our other episodes, and please leave a like and a rating.